Hey, this is Mike Patterson, your host for Embrace Growth. This is a podcast dedicated to personal growth and empowered choices, helping to create change and transformation in your life and the world. Today on the show, I speak with my friend Mariano Guas from Ocala, Florida. Mariano was not born in this country. He shares his story about moving here, some of the trials and tribulations in his life, and spells out some really optimistic things that you could possibly use for your own personal journey. It's really good. And I dearly love this man and all the wisdom that he shares. Stick around. Hey, Mariano, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Everybody, today I'm speaking with Mariano Guas. He currently lives in Ocala, Florida. We're going to get to know him a little bit better and his story over the course of this show. First, go ahead, Mariano. Introduce yourself to the world and however you want to be known in this moment.
Well, sure. I'm Mariano Guas. I am Cuban born. I'm a 74-year-old man, married for 51, almost 52 years to my beautiful wife, Linda. And we have two grown children who themselves are married and live productive lives. And they have blessed us with five biological grandchildren. We got some extended grandchildren somewhere around another 11 total that claim us. Some are kind of related by blood, others just by family of choice. I'm a retired veterinarian. I've been retired for a long time, and we'll talk about that because that was a significant point in my life, my retirement from veterinary medicine.
All right. Well, thanks. And everybody today, so I've known Mariano for, I think, about 10 years, Mariano, if I'm not mistaken. We know each other through the Mankind Project. We've led trainings together all over North America. I invited him to the show today. The name of the show is Coming to America. And so we're going to start with your story of what it was like to come to this country as a young boy.
Good. Yeah, I was 12 years old as I was born in Cuba, in Havana, Cuba. And I lived a privileged life there. It was more about, not so much about the wealth, but about the family connections. You know, there was some political connections. But in January the 1st of 1959, Fidel Castro took over. And at first there were many people that were enamored with him, even in the United States. But it wasn't long before the true colors were showing. And my father was very intuitive about this. So in September of 1959, my father, for my well-being, and my mother sent me to the United States. I was 12 years old at the time. And I went... Actually, my mother brought me. I don't want to say that they just shipped me off. And I went to a Catholic boarding school in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And that was a turning point in my life, as you can imagine. I was 12 years old. Spoke some English, but not perfect, but enough to get by. And it was a difficult time in my life. As you can imagine, 12 years old, being away from home in a new country, the safety and nurturing of my parents was gone. At the school, it was a good school, and of course it was run by the brothers, and there were rules, and there were in fact I was I used to kind of act out in school in Cuba, and the first night we were there, about five non-English speaking boys got in trouble because they didn't understand what they were supposed to be doing, and they all got the strap.
Mm.
That was one of my conversion points in my life. I understood it was time to walk the line.
You were one of the five?
No, I understood enough English. Yeah, but just by chance, I wasn't caught up in that.
Got it.
I mean, I can tell you the details. It was like you put a red tag on your bed. We slept in this huge barrack, 100 beds in there, old metal beds. And then if you hang a tag on your bed, the brother would wake you up half an hour earlier than everybody else. Well, these guys, they put the tag on their bed because one of the fellas that had been there a few days told them do that. So they went and played handball.
Mm.
Catch was that the reason you were supposed to put the tag on there was so you could go to mass.
Oh, not go play.
Not go play. And these fellows, they were just unaware because they didn't speak the language. They didn't understand what they were doing. So they were getting the strap. I mean, it was like a barber razor strap, like, you know, you see, and they were all lined up and they were getting that. And when I saw that, like I said, I had my conversion. I no longer acted out. I walked the line.
What was it like? I mean, you've said now a couple of times, you can imagine. And I can't imagine. I can't imagine being 12 years old, taken from my family, not knowing the language really well, and being put in a boarding school. What was needed for you to get through that experience?
Well, yeah, let me tell you what it was like. I was scared. I was lonely. I was homesick. I was scared. Not only I was scared for myself, of course, but I was also scared about my parents.
Right.
Not knowing. I mean, there was a time when the Bay of Pigs invasion was going on, and you know, my parents lived near a military base, and planes had been flying. You know, they're just right over the house. So those things really were unsettling. Here I was in the United States and relatively safe, and they were over there. So yeah, there was all of that, the fear, loneliness, the homesickness.
And the only communication back then was letters?
Well, no, there was telephone, but it was, you know, you had to call the operator, the long distance operator, and I didn't have access to a phone. They would call the school, and then the school would get me wherever I was, and then I would go there and talk. And that didn't happen very often.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Is it?
Yeah. Letters. Right, you're right. No email, no WhatsApp. Right. None of the things that we've just become so accustomed to nowadays. And I will tell you that what I believe I got out of that experience was a sense of self-sufficiency.
Okay.
I have, throughout my life, been a man that I've stood on my own two feet. Things that I've done, you know, I've done because of my own personal drive and the survival that I learned. That, you know, the coping mechanism was survival.
Right. You can say it's self-sufficiency now, but then it was survival.
Correct. Yeah. It was the survival, which resulted in, you know, eventually being able to, you know, just be able to stand on my own 2 feet. I was doing it then, without any choice. So
you're 12 years old in a boarding school, and then how many years were you in this country by yourself at a boarding school without your parents?
Yeah, it wasn't that bad in that sense. I went home that Christmas, and then I went home that following summer, so the summer of 1960, and that was really the last time I was in Cuba, because I was getting ready to go home for the Christmas of 1960, the 60-61 Christmas break, and I got a phone call the night before, and my parents said, "Oh no, don't come to Cuba. We're canceling your trip. Your mother and your brother are coming up to celebrate." My grandmother lived in the United States, to celebrate your grandmother's 80th birthday or whatever. And while that was partially true, it was code for "we're getting your brother out of Cuba."
Oh, wow.
So they did come, and my brother came to the boarding school in mid-school year, my second year.
So it was that hush-hush.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to understand a little bit about the way the communism works and worked there. I mean, there were, you know how you have a neighborhood watch here in the United States? Well, they have a neighborhood watch, but it's somebody watching you to make sure that you are not speaking against the state, that you're not conducting any activities that go against the government. And yeah, and everybody's listening to you, watching you.
So now with two sons in the United States, and was it just you and your brother? Or is that the only siblings?
Yes.
Then, yeah, how long then until your parents are...
Right. My mother came a few months later that summer. And then my father came when I was like a junior in high school, which would have been 63. So, well, there you have it, those years.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll tell you this, when my father left, he left with two suits, one on and one in a bag. You know, they went in the house, they inventoried everything. They went for a ride in the car with him, make sure he hadn't done anything to sabotage it. And he had to surrender all that to the government. And, you know, my dad was a lawyer in Cuba. I know your dad was a lawyer, so, you know. Correct. And, you know, he got to this country and, you know, professionally he was not able to do it. As I've told you in some of our previous conversations, you know, he was 50 years old at the time, and he never recovered either emotionally or financially from that.
From leaving Cuba?
From the loss. Uh-huh. Yeah. The loss of the lifestyle, the loss of the homeland, the loss of everything he knew and had worked, you know, half a century to develop and build.
Yeah. And then ultimately that.
Yes. If you want, we can go into that. You know, 20 years later, when he was 70 years old, he died by suicide. He suffered from depression from time to time, and some of the depressions were worse than others. And, you know, he told me one day, he said, "I'm never going back there again," meaning he wasn't going to get depressed like the last time. And I believe that he felt that he was going down that trail again. And I believe that's what resulted in him taking his life.
That he just didn't want to go back to that pain.
No, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to realize this is 1984. We didn't have the antidepressant drugs that we have now. Mental health awareness and the openness was not what it is. You know, the shame that, you know, a grown man would have. So it was, there was a lot of contributing factors.
In this episode, we're talking about coming to America. And so you coming to America is one story, and then your father coming to America is another story.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mm. And so in 1984, how old were you, Mariano?
I think I was 38.
Uh-huh. And with this very significant life event, what was going on for you?
It's interesting. The way it went down was like this. The day of his death was February 29th. Hmm. That day didn't come back up again till
right leap year.
4 years.
Yeah.
Till 1988. And for me, I had, well, the grief, but the shame. I think I need to put the shame on top. The shame that I felt that my father had died by suicide. It was so much so, Mike, that at the funeral, you know, the story was he died of a heart attack.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't say suicide. 4 years. During that 4 year period, I did everything you can imagine to avoid dealing with this. I was just active in a million things, just busy chasing a dollar, I remember I was involved in some organizations, some meetings, some veterinary. We had an extra emergency clinic, and I was part of the board there. And we'd have meetings after work, get home at 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. After having had a few drinks, I'd get up at 5 in the morning and go ride 25 miles on a bicycle and then go to work from 8 in the morning till 6 in the afternoon. You know, it was just ongoing, just that type of
distraction, just anything you can do to fill every moment with something so that you don't have to think about this.
So I don't have to feel and do what I ultimately got to do. Interestingly enough, as February 29th of 1988 was approaching, I started to feel bad. I started to feel very, very uncomfortable. I started to feel and depressed. And I had a friend of mine, Charlie Hino, and he said, you know, I go and I talk to this guy once a week and I feel better. And I said, yeah, what's his name? So I called this therapist. And I started seeing him. And that's when I really started my work.
1988.
Correct.
Okay.
And so this is the gift that I got from my father's traumatic death.
Is that you started to wake up to your own
pain and who I really was and what was inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
It was about that time that men's movement was starting to get going. Robert Bly, Michael Meade, And there was a couple of men in the audience that organized a retreat for men, and 17 of us showed up.
What was that called?
It was the New Orleans Men's Center.
Okay.
It didn't even have that name. So here we were, bunch of men, and we didn't know what we're doing, but it didn't matter because we got to be together and we got to start talking about our pain and what the life of a man was like, the real life.
You were full-time living in New Orleans at this point.
All right. I was a practicing veterinarian. I had my own veterinary practice. I was married and had my two children. When we got ready to leave, we said, this is so good. We got to do more. So we started meeting and we organized the New Orleans Men's Center. And then from then on, we had two retreats a year. And we would meet twice a month. And we're doing drumming and poetry and just, you know, sharing from our hearts what was going on with us. And that was an unbelievable experience for me. It was, you know, we got therapy. Now we got, you know, connecting with men at a deep level, at an authentic level. You know, Michael Meade used to say that the average man only had one friend, one good friend. Mm-hmm. And I was changing this for myself.
Right.
So then, a man by the name of Mickey Nodruff went to New Mexico to this thing called the Mankind Project. He did a new warrior training adventure, and he came back. And he convinced a couple of guys to go and tried me. And I said, no, man, I got my life all squared away. You know, everything just fine. And so then this other fellow went. And he's a philosophy professor at Loyola University. And he's got hair way out here. And he came back and he said, this is the greatest thing I've ever experienced in all of my life. And I said, I want some of that.
Were these guys part of the New Orleans Men's Center?
Yeah.
These are guys you're really connected to.
Right.
They're going off to do this thing and coming back changed.
Right.
Saying that this is the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
Well, this is a good time to mention the Mankind Project. Imagine a circle of men, a circle of brothers, where everyone listens not only to what you say, but also the truth beneath your words. Imagine a circle that will remind you of your commitments so that you can hold yourself accountable and keep you moving towards your aspirations and goals. Imagine a circle of men who will help you clarify your vision and provide tools for action and learning that lead you to the life that you want. Men who absolutely tell you the whole truth about where you are strong and where you sell yourself short. Imagine breaking free of limiting beliefs that sabotage you, having the powerful part of you called forth with a new set of beliefs. Imagine a circle where you can experience and develop a leader within you, a place that is safe to be who you really want to be. This is how the Mankind Project groups work. For more information, visit mankindproject.org.
So the second man went and he went to Houston. So not long after that, in June of 1996, I went. And I did my new warrior training adventure. And as you know, but our listeners may not all know, what a powerful experience that is for men.
Right.
You know, it's a life-changing event. It's an initiatory, men's initiatory experience, a healthy and appropriate initiatory experience, and as well as, you know, I think a leadership training, and it serves as a tremendous instrument for self-awareness and personal growth. And most importantly, it helps me see what might be blocking me. You know, what is the shadow? What is that part of me that's keeping me from being my best self?
Right. And that's all parts and pieces of this training.
Correct.
So there you are in 96. You have this life-changing experience going to a new warrior training adventure. And so from there, what changes came about in your life recently after that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So 2 years later, I had a calling.
I love when I hear that because it means something so big to me. But how did you experience the calling? I'm really curious.
Can I talk to you about what a calling is?
Well, I know what it is for me, but I absolutely.
Well, let me just tell you. I think you might like this.
All right.
The word vocatus in Latin means calling. Calling. And that's where the word vocation comes from.
Huh.
And I believe that somewhere along the line, I can only speak for men, I don't know about women, but for men, somewhere in the middle, they may get a calling. I think we all get a calling. And I have a belief that at least three things can happen. So one is I can hear the calling and I can answer it. Mm-hmm. I can hear the calling and ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can be so unaware and unawake and chasing
distractions.
Things. It's kind of like somebody did between 84 and 88 that I cannot even hear it. So a man can just miss the calling altogether. A man can hear it and refuse to go along and, you know, to listen, and or he can answer. So for me, as I mentioned before, I was a practicing veterinarian. I had a successful veterinary practice. And 2 years after my warrior training adventure, I decided to sell my veterinary practice and devote my life to doing work with two-legged creatures instead of the four-legged creatures. So I started working with men. I was very involved in Mankind Project. This time I was in New Orleans, and I was still in New Orleans, and I was we organized, along with those two fellows that went before me, we developed the community there for New Orleans, for the Mankind Project. I did a lot of trainings. I did, you know, I led a lot of integration. They used to be called an initial integration group.
Right.
We call them PITs now. And I would take a lot of men. I would invite a lot of men to go to Houston. We could fly for $49 on Southwest in those days. So it was a pretty nice deal. And we would go there. And so slowly I would invite men from the New Orleans Men's Center once they'd kind of come to know me and gain my trust. And I gained their trust. Sorry, I got that backwards. But we trusted each other, let me put it that way, enough that I would say, you know, you might want to consider doing this. And the ones that said yes, and We were ready to have a training.
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans, in 2005.
Uh-oh.
Exactly. So we had bought all our materials. We had a number of men enrolled. We had people coming from various parts of the country. Everybody's very excited.
What month was the training supposed to take place?
October.
Okay.
And we had 17 men enrolled. And we're 6 weeks out. And then Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana and Mississippi. And life changed once again for many people, myself included. Our home flooded. We had standing water in it for 21 days.
Ooh.
And I was in Houston when Katrina hit.
Mm-hmm.
I was being part of a training there that I was leading. And
so you weren't even home.
No. There were very few people that stayed in New Orleans. They got everybody to evacuate. The ones that stayed.
You were out of town working. You weren't necessarily evacuating or.
Correctly.
Okay.
In fact, let me just tell you a little bit about the details of that. You know how I like the details of a story. Mm-hmm. All I had was shorts and t-shirts.
Okay.
And, yeah, I lost all my clothes. So, and I called the airline to evacuate, to get Linda on a plane, my wife. And the lady said, I only got two seats left. And she goes, oh, click, click. They're gone. So that was a good thing in that she was able to drive her car. She drove her car from New Orleans to John Gaughan and Rhonda Gaughan's home in Houston, our dear friends and, you know, warrior brothers. And we ended up living there for 6 weeks.
Mm. And at least you had a car.
You got it. That's exactly right. So because she couldn't fly out, we only lost one house and one car instead of one house and two cars. So the Houston, you know, I don't know if you want to go into all this, but the Houston community, they fed us, they housed us, they gave us clothes.
And you're talking about the Houston Mankind Project community.
Thank you.
Because so many people went to Houston
right
after Katrina.
Right. Yeah. In fact, that's a very valid point. You know, we would walk into a restaurant and they would say, you from New Orleans? They could just, I guess, see it in our faces. And they wouldn't charge us for a meal.
Oh, wow.
I went to the YMCA. I was a member in New Orleans, but I went to the one in Houston. And the lady, you know, I was getting ready to sign up or pay or something. She said, oh, I gave her my driver. She said, you from New Orleans? No, you get 6 weeks free. So yes, the Mankind Project Houston community did a lot for myself and the other New Orleans men. But the city of Houston opened their arms and their wallets and everything for people that were impacted by Katrina.
Mm. That's so beautiful to hear, because I wasn't living down there and I was just watching things on TV. And I know that a lot of people went to Houston, but that's just a beautiful inside story to hear. So thanks for sharing that. So you've had quite a few different impactful things happen in a negative sense in your lifetime. So it's 05, Katrina hits, your house is gone and one car. And so then what?
Well, I want to say that in between those negatively impactful events, there have been a lot of good things in my life. So I want to, you know, I don't want to get on here and start sounding like it's all been a downhill trip. I've been blessed with a lot of good stuff.
Let's hear about the different learnings out of these pieces.
All right.
if we go back, 1959, you move, you're 12 years old, you move to the Gulf Shore. What did you learn out of being in a boarding school by yourself, away from your family?
Right. Well, I can list a few things. You know, one of them is a sense of discipline, you know, and kind of organization. You know, there was a very structured environment. Mm-hmm. And that has served me well, you know, the good takeaway. And as we talked about earlier, you know, there was a thing of just being a survivor, self-sufficiency, just being able to know that I can rely on myself.
Yeah. And so if we go back to 1959, you're 12, there's no necessarily personal growth work that's conscious, but you're learning discipline, organization, and learning to be self-sufficient.
Right. I want to say that along with that came the grief. You know, there's been that I've carried in my life. I haven't walked around with a long face all my life, but there's grief in there by the loss of my homeland.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not, you know, that's not a small thing.
Right.
So you were going to go forward to what? What was the next thing you wanted to?
I'm kind of following the timeline of significant events. So in 1984, with losing your father to suicide, for 4 years, you stuffed that down. But looking back on those 4 years, what did you learn?
Looking back on the 4 years before I was awakened, I guess I learned creative avoidance, which is not a good thing.
Yeah, we're not here to teach that.
No. But, you know, in retrospect, after the fact, after I acted the way I did, the gift is how important it is to be connected with, connect my outside with my inside, with what, you know, what's going on inside of me with the way I'm living and the way I'm acting, and make space to feel the grief. One of the things that I've learned about grief, one of my beliefs about it, is that the emotion of grief itself is really a very pure, almost a beautiful thing. It is the energy that I expend running around the trying to avoid going in there that is... The problem, like, for lack of a better term. I remember, I mean, I'm just going to throw in when my mother passed away of natural causes in the year 2000, the pain, by now I had already, if you will, awakened and had, you know, self-awareness, and I was doing... it felt so okay, and I don't want to say good, but as I felt the grief and the pain, it was just, there was no resistance.
Right.
There was no inclination to avoid the pain. And, you know, you've had losses that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. And so I think you might know what I think you understand what I'm talking about, do you?
I so understand what you're talking about, but you articulated it in a way that I haven't connected with. to think about just really how pure and beautiful grief is. I couldn't have said it any better.
Yeah.
But I absolutely know what you're talking about, and how in times before I had the support of the network that I do now, the energy expelled to avoid the grief.
Right. Yeah, we expend a lot. I mean, I did it for 4 years. And that was, and to this day, you know, it's when I'm able to drop into it, it is, yeah, and even now as we're talking, you know, I felt it and I saw it in you.
Yeah. Yes.
And so it's a very freeing experience.
It's very human.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I love most about my emotional bandwidth at this point in my life, is to just know how very human I am.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the thing about emotions and feelings are that they're just messages from the psyche that, you know, they're for our own good. I mean, for our own survival, for our own safety, every one of them, you know.
It's good information.
Good information. Yeah. It's just up to me to, hey, am I going to turn the radio on and listen to this program? Or am I going to turn the volume down and go do something else?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Let me bring the conversation back around. And one of the great gifts that came out of between 1984 and 1988 and shortly after that was the ability to feel.
Correct.
Connect to yourself.
Yeah, the awareness of the feelings. I think the ability to feel is there. We just they were firing. I promise you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. To connect with what the messages really, the emotional messages were. So, did you ask a question, or you just made that statement?
No. I'm just again following this timeline.
Yeah.
Now, the next significant thing I have on this timeline is 96. You.
Right.
Or we can take 1988 to 1996. You're involved in a men's group, but you go and experience this new warrior training adventure, and something was so profound in you that 2 years later you decided to sell your practice. So what was learned between 96 and 98?
Wow. Yeah. Well, I think the continuation of what had started, you know, in 88, because not only did I join the men's group, but I was doing some personal therapy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just emotional awareness, the ability to be able to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about emotional bandwidth, you know. That's what happens when I'm vulnerable. Or my emotional bandwidth is what allows me to be vulnerable, and vulnerable equals being real, which is being authentic.
Now you're getting involved in some really cool tools here. You know, the learnings of vulnerability and authenticity is... Right. Is really what's learned, and then right. The practice of right. Continuing.
Yeah, and you know, one of my big takeaways from the Mankind Project has been the importance of living a life of integrity. And for me, you know, we define it as, you know, what I say and what I think and what I do are all in alignment. But for me, integrity is when I am living in alignment with my core values. The things that matter most to me, if my life is reflecting that, then firing on all eight cylinders. So, yeah. And the other piece, the other beautiful thing, you know, and I, you know, you and I know all this, we talk about it all the time, is, you know, the fact that everything I do is a choice. How empowering is that?
Yes.
You know, it's either a conscious or an unconscious choice. And that takes me out of the victim place. The victim, I'm powerless, I can't help myself, I can't do anything. And, you know, I've had times of depression in my life. And there is a very victim-y spot for me in that depression. And it's a dark, ugly place. And there's learning. There's always light. But it doesn't feel like it when I'm in it.
Right.
I got this little thing that I love. It says, everything is a choice. This is life's greatest truth and its hardest lesson. It's a great truth because it reminds us of our power. And it's not power over others, but the often untapped power to be ourselves and to live the life we have imagined. It is a hard lesson because it causes us to realize that we have chosen the life we are living. So the good news is that I get a choice. And that sets me up. There's consequences.
Right. There's consequences to all of our choices.
Correct. So knowing that I have the choice and that it has consequences is huge learning. Talk about being able to live a life of consciousness.
Yeah, and the burden that goes with that, right?
That's what I'm talking about. If I don't like the life I'm living, guess what? I created it, so I get to choose.
Correct. With all of this consciousness, with you saying firing on all eight cylinders, when 05 hit, you were set up in a different way.
Yeah. Okay.
So 05 hits, right? It's a big deal to all of New Orleans.
Right.
There's grief, there's loss, there's all of this. But you are a different man at this point than you were in 84.
Right. Yeah, I have a dear friend from New Orleans, James Brooks, and we were sitting there in Houston. And I told him, I said, you know, I've had prior training for this experience. You know, I lost my homeland. I lost Cuba when I was 12. And I believe I was like 59 in 05. Mm-hmm. And so I lost material things in Katrina. And we lost our community of friends, and specifically the Mankind Project friends that I had in New Orleans, my support group, all the men that I loved, and everybody was scattered and went everywhere. So the takeaway, the lesson could be about the problem with attachment to things, to worldly things. Yeah, you know, I remember one night Linda said, she was crying. We just turned off the lights, we were in bed, she was crying, and she said, we lost our home. And I said, no, sweetheart, we lost our house. Our home is where you and I put our heads on the pillow. And, you know, it's a fine wordsmithing, but there's a piece of great reality to that for me and for us in our heart. Didn't totally minimize it. It wasn't intended to discount her pain, but it was intended to have a little reality check.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And from there, you lived in Houston for a bit. Mm-hmm. When did you move to Florida?
In 08.
In 08.
Yeah, okay. we thought we were going to stay in Houston. We made a conscious decision to not go back to New Orleans. Like I said, I was 59. We were both 59, and we didn't want to go back and rebuild. And, like I said, all our friends scattered all over the country. So we bought a place in Houston, and we were very happy. And my daughter married a young man from Ocala. And by now they had three children. And we were quite often we were driving and from New Orleans to over here, it was 9 hours. And then from Houston, it was even longer. I knew every bump on I-10. And one day, I was smoking a cigar and drinking a beer in a Chase Lounge in the lake where my son-in-law's got a nice place. And the kids were jumping all over me. My daughter said, "Dad, if you lived here, you could have this every day."
So that's all it took.
Exactly. I looked at Linda and she said, "Don't look at me." So we moved 3 months later, we were here. And it's been wonderful. We watched our grandchildren grow up. The ones here, and we got two boys in DC, and we go up there all the time. And I would tell you that we're going to be here for the duration. However, the only thing I know now is that I don't know what's next. You talk about learnings.
There you go.
But whatever it comes, we'll roll with it.
So I've been taking some notes of the learnings through the timeline of Mariano Guas's life. But how would you want to recap this conversation? Or what can you leave the listeners with from this conversation? What's something that they can learn from you in your life lessons?
Well, I don't know that I have any magic formulas. It would be rather let's see. Listen to the pain. Pay attention, because that's a sign. It's a sign. Something needs mining. So be a miner, look inside deep. Don't try to do it alone. We didn't talk about it, but I think spiritual practice is a very important piece. It certainly is for me and for my wife, Linda. Our faith is important to us, and I'm not attached to mine. I mean, I am for mine, but I'm like, we didn't talk about this either, but I believe in taking care of the physical. I think of the physical, the body is like the slab, the foundation. And if I look at it like there's the physical, then there's the mental, where we need to exercise our mind and be focused and alert. And then there's the emotional, where I want to be connected with my deeper self, and then spiritually aligned with something greater than my own self-interest. And this, going back to what I was talking about, the core values, if I'm able to be living my life that way, it's a good day.
Firing on all eight cylinders.
Right on. I guess that'll be going by the wayside as we go into more and more electric vehicles. I'll have to come up with a new one.
Right. But integrity is integrity, regardless of how many cylinders or...
Yeah, whatever expression we use to describe it. You're absolutely right, my friend.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for that recap. Thank you so much for sharing your life, your story, your wisdom with me and with all that are tuning in to listen to it. I just really respect you and I'm honored to have you here on the show. Thanks, Mariano.
Thank you, Mike. It's always delightful to be with you, my friend. Blessings.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Embrace Growth. Please subscribe, that way you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. And if you'd leave us a 5-star review at iTunes or wherever you're listening, it helps other people find the show. And tell your friends too. That'll help them find the show as well. We got some good stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. I speak with my friend Bobby Bakshi from LA. We have a discussion about internalized depression. And then I also have a conversation with Martin Lassoff from Texas. And it's just fascinating. He shares his story, and I'm not gonna ruin that one for you. You're going to want to tune in for that one. So this week was brought to you by Leader Champions. Leader Champions offers online group coaching, one-on-one coaching, a way to take a look at your personal growth work, a way to look at your leadership. We believe it's all encompassing at Leader Champions. Go to www.leaderchampions.com. Check it all out. New episodes appear every Monday. That way you can start off your week in a good way. So until next Monday, until next week, until next time, please embrace your own personal growth and support others to embrace theirs. Take care.